everyone. Welcome back. Post-Christmas, Fundamentally Sound Podcast, episode 44. I'm your host, as always, Reeves from Barstool Sports. Joined with me is my guy over at, and there's a couple things you can find him at, but he is at cardchronicle.com, one of the college basketball editors and writers for SB Nation, and co-host of Ramsey and Rutherford on 790 KRD over in Louisville, and that's my guy, Mike Rutherford. Mike, what's going on, man?
Not too much, Reeves. Thanks for having me back, man.
Yeah, I mean, it had to, right? Like, Kentucky-Louisville's tomorrow, it was bound to happen. I think it was, like, written in our imaginary contracts.
That's exactly right. I was hoping I would get the invite for this week in particular, and I'm glad it came through.
So obviously, this is going to be a lot of Kentucky-Louisville talk, and then some early season observations, because it's, you know, starting to pick back up again with the season, with conference play going. But we'll start, obviously, with Kentucky-Louisville, since that's probably why most people are listening in on this one. We're recording this here on Thursday, about 6:45 Eastern. I think it was Nick's tweet, or it was your tweet, about what the poll for the what time the game, when you would like the game played. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. What's your thought on that? Because I know, like, when the schedule came out, and I saw Friday, 1 o'clock, I was just like, that's the dumbest shit in the world. And like, that's putting it kindly.
Yeah, this is the weirdest game in the series history, I think. I mean, I have to go back and look at the weirdness of some past games. But, I mean, Friday, non-holiday Friday, mind you, at right. 1 o'clock, you've got, Rick Pitino, the defining figure of this rivalry since really like the late 80s. Because even when he was gone, and with the Celtics, he was still not out of mind. It was, you know, his imprint was all over that UK program.
Oh, yeah.
And then he comes to U of L, and it, you know, he's the main figure there. So it's the first year he's out of the picture. You've got both teams kind of underachieving up to this point. I think it's the first time Louisville's been unranked in this game since Calipari's first year, the Jared Swapshire DeMarcus Cousins throwdown year. And UK is, I think, the first time they've been out of the top 15 for this game since the year that they wound up going to the NIT. So it's a weird game.
I didn't like, and I agree with you, it's a weird setup for the game, right? Like, both are coming off, Kentucky's coming off.
I would say mid-February is the best time for the game, and I was surprised at how much in the minority I was.
See, I get mid-February, but I like it because, yeah, you're right, it's just basketball at that time. Like, you're not competing with the NFL. You're not competing with college football. But I don't know. I always liked it kicking off the CBS season, right? Like, that felt to me the start of college basketball.
Yeah.
One of the true starts of college basketball, because it was always, to me, like, the 24-hour marathon, the Maui Invitational, and then CBS, you know, that first time you hear the dun 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 dun.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, it's college basketball season. And for a while, I believe it was always Kentucky-Louisville that was the first CBS game, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. And, like, I like it for tradition's sake. You know, it's always kind of been around Christmas or New Year's, right, yeah, in that little area. And it signifies the end of conference or non-conference play and, you know, the start of conference play. But I feel like, see, Louisville, Kentucky fans, they don't want to move the game, but they also want the same national attention that North Carolina Duke gets.
Right.
And I'm like, it's not going to happen. Cause that first UNC-Duke game, it's always or almost always that first week right after the Super Bowl when the casual American sports fan is kind of like, all right, no more football. College basketball, what's good?
You know, Duke, North Carolina. I know those teams.
Yeah, and the teams are always good. We have a firm resume about, you know, what they are and what they're about. And, you know, Louisville, Kentucky, it's always sandwiched in between bowl games and the holiday season and the NFL playoff picture. And I feel like, you know, you don't really have a full identity a lot of times, too, of how good those teams are or how not good those teams are. I'd love to see it, you know, smack dab in the middle of February so we know exactly what the teams are. It'd be a nice diversion from, I don't want to say mundane conference play, but sometimes you get in too much of a rhythm where you see the same teams play night in, night out in the same days of the week.
Yeah.
So I would like to see it happen there, but I also get people who want to keep it in late December.
With what you said about the breakup in conference play, that's why I love the SEC Big 12 Challenge.
Yeah.
Because it's at Saturday. I it's in January, so it's like it's wild card weekend, I believe, or divisional weekend. So, you know, you're only dealing with four football games max, so you're not really, you know, sandwiched in over that weekend. And it's been good games. Obviously, like Kentucky, Kansas have highlighted it the last 2 years. But like, LSU played Oklahoma, the Simmons and Buddy Hield year. Like, that was a really fun game. I'm all for stuff like that because, yeah, I get conference play, but conferences are expanding. Like, everyone's going to end up playing 20 games here soon. As nice as it is to get the, quote, big name matchups, like, you know, okay, like we said, with not even just like Duke, Carolina, but, you know, like the, I don't know, Notre Dame, Virginia, like everybody knows those two teams. You sit down, you know, okay, this is going to be a game worth watching for teams that are going to be in the NCAA tournament. It's nice to have that breakup, like you said, because, I mean, how many people are sitting down for a, you know, Auburn, you know, LSU game or something like that? And no disrespect to either of those teams, but it, that doesn't get the casual fan involved, which is what should be college basketball's goal.
Sure. No, and last year I thought it was really cool too, because occasionally this deal will kind of come in and break up narratives that we formed through the first few weeks of conference play. Like, you know, let's say the SEC, it continues on this trend and everybody's saying, you know, it's so much better than it has been in years past, and it could, you know, put a record number of teams in the tournament. And then, you know, a month from now, they just get hammered by the Big 12 in this challenge. Now, obviously, you can't take too much away from a one-game deal, but if it's teams across the board, if it's Tennessee getting killed, Kentucky getting killed, Florida getting killed, A&M getting killed, then all of a sudden you kind of change things a little bit. And I think I like that mid-conference play shakeup, which is why I'd like to see like one of the big time non-conference rivalry games put there. But again, I also kind of get the, hey, it kicks off the conference portion of the season. It's the first CBS game. I get both sides. I was just surprised that that poll, I think we had like 1500 votes. Almost half of them said, keep it in late December. I was surprised it was that overwhelming.
Yeah, I agree. But really what I think could solve it is just one of my solutions to fix the game, which is just starting the season in December.
And then, yeah,
this,
no,
and then this game
there.
Is played in February regardless, or end of January instead of end of December. And, you know, as long as it's not Super Bowl weekend, I think you're fine.
Yeah, I just think everybody around here, and you went to UK, so you know about how people kind of, like, they want it all. They want things their way, but they also want the rest of the country to see things their way. So people around here were furious a few years ago when the game was on ESPN2. You know, it's the biggest rivalry in the world. How can you possibly put it on ESPN2? Well, when you play this time of the year, bowl games are going to get preferential treatment from all the networks. It's why the game's being played on a non-holiday Friday at 1 p.m. this year. So if you want the game to stay here, you're going to have to put up with some of the crap that comes along with it, and that's not getting an ideal television slot. I mean, last year they played on a Tuesday night at 7 o'clock?
It was a Tuesday at 7, because I remember it was like the night before everybody kind of left. I obviously live in Cincinnati. The night before, everyone left to, like, go home for the holiday break. Like, because Christmas Eve was, you know, people had off work Friday or whatever, Thursday, Friday. So it's like, okay, well, you leave on Wednesday.
Yeah, that was a crazy thing, too, because so the way it went down, according to my knowledge, is Louisville scheduled that game against Indiana, and the only time they could play it was New Year's Eve. And so they went to Kentucky because that was, you know, the time slot that the UK U of L game typically is, that weekday or that weekend between Christmas and New Year's. And they said, hey, we got a scheduling conflict. Are you cool with playing it an earlier Saturday? And UK was like, sure. So they settled on December the 10th. And then Kentucky found out that the reason they got bumped was for Indiana,
right,
who they've had their own little beef with. And they were like, no, we're not playing the 10th. And they ended up having to settle on I think it was the 21st on a Tuesday. So that was, again, the weird scheduling quirks that come from having a rivalry game in mid to late December.
But I'd still rather have that Tuesday night game, because there was really nothing else on. Although that was the night that Grayson tripped the kid from Elon.
That's exactly right. And he had the freak out on the bench.
Yeah, that was that night. So that dominated the storyline, the college basketball world, unfortunately. But at least like that Tuesday night, you're going up against, like, I don't know, whatever, the Holiday Bowl or something like that. And it's like, okay, I as a college basketball fan, I will live with that than rather the 1 o'clock Friday where it's going to get buried. Like, it's going to get buried because not only on the same day, but you have USC Ohio State tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no matter what happens, and I want to start talking about the game now, but it's a – and I think Doster – I think Dosser was the one who said it, where this is just a good gauge game, right? Like, we don't know exactly how good either of these teams truly are, or how bad these teams are, because it could go either way. I think when it's all said and done, I think it's going to lean both on the good side for both teams, but we have no idea, right? Like, there haven't been a lot of tests. The big games have been weird on both sides. That Louisville-Purdue game was, to me, just a weird game. Like, Louisville should have won that game. Purdue ended up coming back, and it was sloppy and it was physical, which is fine because that's how Louisville tends to play. They want to play physical. They want to kind of ugly the game up. And I guess, what's your take? Is it a good gauge game, even though it's this early? Is it one that I think it's going to be a springboard game for whoever wins.
No, I think that's totally a fair point. I think that's what both sides are really hoping for, because, like you said, I mean, there's this overwhelming sense that Louisville's not going to be able to handle all the extenuating stuff, all the, you know, getting a Hall of Fame coach taken away from your team 2 days before the start of practice, that they're not going to be able to bounce back from that. And plus, losing Brian Bowen, who was a five-star kid who probably, I think, would have started and played multiple guard positions
regardless,
for this team.
Coaches are planning him in the rotation and things around him.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. But I think that the narrative now with Louisville is, well, they might be okay, but they're not going to be the top 20 caliber team that we thought they were going to be. And similarly, like Kentucky now, I think that a lot of people are doubting whether or not they're going to be able to be a legit, you know, 2-3 seed type team, because they don't have, you know, it's not just the traditional Cal thing where they're a lot of freshmen and they're slow starting. They don't have like that superstar guaranteed top 5 NBA draft pick. And I think people are wondering whether or not they're going to be able to bounce back from that. And when I say bounce back, I don't mean, you know, like make the tournament or anything. I mean, like become a national
second weekend
team. Totally. Yeah.
Like, I think that's a question mark.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And I think both sides are hoping that a win on Friday sort of catapults them into shifting the direction of their season and into conference play. Whether or not that actually happens, I kind of have my doubts about both. I mean, I look at both teams and I'm just sort of like, I don't know if relative to their expectations, either is going to be good. Like, is that putting it too simply?
No, I mean, I agree. I was very high on Louisville even after all the shit. Like, after they lost Pitino, after they lost Bowen, everything. Because I'm still looking going, all right, well, Padgett was at least in the system. The guys know him. He knows the guys. They still have Snyder. They still have, Adele. They still have Mahmood. They still have, you know, I like Spalding. And it's going, okay, well, I think I had him like the third, fourth best team in the ACC in the top 15 team. And it's like just watching them through the first, what have they played, 13 games so far this year? And it's like they might be in and out of the top 25 and the top 6-7 team in the ACC. Right? Like,
yeah.
Does that feel? And then again, that all changes. Like, if they go in and win at Rupp, maybe you're going, all right, well, maybe top 5 in the ACC, and now maybe like in and out of the top 20 could be more logical, because it's still a road win at, you know, I think Rupp Arena's wildly kind of overrated, but for big games, it's a hard place to win.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely more to be gained here for Louisville than there is for Kentucky. But having said that, I mean, this is now, it's the last non-conference game for both teams. And I think that, I guess no disrespect to Virginia Tech, but this would be the biggest win to date for whichever team prevails in this game. And
the one thing, though, is Kentucky does have that trip to West Virginia.
That's true. I totally forgot about that. The aforementioned Big 12 SEC challenge.
Because, ironically enough, like if they lose this game, they still can change the narrative by winning that January 12th game, I think it is, in Morgantown.
Yeah, but for Louisville, there's really, I mean, this is it. Like, they've played two teams that are going to be in the NCAA tournament that could earn at-large bids, and they've lost to both of them, one of which came at home. This is your last chance to notch one of those, as the new selection committee tier deal is, a tier one victory, a quality non-conference road win over a team that's probably going to be a top 5, top 6 seed in the NCAA tournament. If they lose this game, then all of a sudden, you're talking about having to not just have a winning record in the ACC, but probably having to have the right combination of wins in the ACC to get into the tournament and get a, you know, maybe a single-digit seed. So there's, I think, more pressure on Louisville than a lot of people in this area are giving them credit for. There's been this weird notion that, well, who cares? You're playing with house money. It's a David Padgett going to Rupp Arena and trying to beat John Calipari there. If they lose, no big deal. Well, I mean, if you think Louisville's terrible and that there are no expectations for the season, then maybe. But if you think they have a legitimate shot to, you know, use this talent and turn this into a success story over the next 3 months, then it is a big deal. So I think you've got a decent amount on the line for both these teams, you know, not just from the rivalry mental aspect, but from a very surface level where they both need a quality win, and Friday's game gives them an opportunity to score that.
What do you think of, I guess, kind of how we're talking, which is how almost everybody talks, is gauging teams based on non-conference, and while you still can kind of change everything in conference play, especially a conference as deep as the ACC, but really you're judging a team like Louisville and Kentucky on three or four games. Like, what's your take on the, I guess, the non-conference schedule that Louisville played, where you know, the first four games were sub 100 teams, sub 150 teams, depending where you look, and then, you know, you go to Purdue, you scheduled Seton Hall, you still have Kentucky, you have Indiana, who you expect to be a little bit better, you have two good mid-majors in Albany and Grand Canyon, a little unlucky with Memphis being so down. I guess, what's your take on the schedule for both teams? Because they both kind of played, I guess, weird is the only way to put it, schedules where you're kind of banking on teams to be a little bit better, and when you play them and they're, you know, a little bit down. Like, I think, you know, Kentucky, maybe you're banking on Monmouth or Harvard being a little bit better and kind of being where they were, but what's your take on the non-conference schedule? Because it's really, like I said, four games that each team has versus notable opponents.
No, you're totally right. I think when Louisville entered into that contract with Indiana, you know, Crean kind of had it, I'm not going to say he had it rolling, but they looked like they were going to be a program that was, you know, safely in the NCAA tournament for the foreseeable future. It looked like it was going to be a good non-conference win every year for Louisville as long as they could get it. And instead, it's been kind of like, well, you know, you beat Indiana. They didn't really do all that much for you. And that's probably going to be the case this year. And yeah, nobody could have seen Memphis falling this far off the face of the earth either. I think where, like, Louisville's got a problem that not a lot of people are talking about. And that's that with the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee still using the RPI as its only real metric that it's focused on, at least for this year, before they start doing the consolidated metric, like, Louisville's RPI is terrible. And that's because they played a lot of teams with sub-250 RPIs. And this is one of those things that Rick Pitino was really good at. He was really good at gaming the RPI system. He would schedule schedule mid to low major teams that were expected to win their conferences, and he would totally avoid the teams that were in the 300s or the lower 200s. And this year's schedule didn't really do that. Now, some of that's not their fault because they played that Gotham Classic, and you don't get to pick your exempt opponents. And I think Bryant and Siena are both right around like 300, which is an absolute killer.
But even then, Siena's typically a team that is one of the, you know, two to three best teams in the other MAC.
The MAC. They Jimmy Patsos usually has them right there competing for titles. And they played a great, overtime game last year in the MAC championship against Iona. So you didn't expect them to be quite this bad. But yeah, St. Francis of Brooklyn has been really bad there. They've got a real low RPI. George Mason hasn't been as good as you'd typically expect them to be. So the schedule is just, it's torpedoed their RPI, which, if they don't have a decent ACC slate and they lose this game to Kentucky on Friday, that's going to become more and more of a factor as the season goes on. Because again, you know, Louisville's RPI was great under Rick Pitino because he knew how to schedule. It did not work out well for them this year. And like you said, they've lost their only two games of note. And if they don't get this one, then you're heading into conference play with really nothing of any sort of substance on your NCAA tournament resume.
What's your take on Kentucky? Because I get asked this a lot, obviously being a Kentucky graduate and writing and watching the game. But, you know, their resume is, I think, a little bit better than Louisville's because they have the win over Virginia Tech, and then they've only had one sub-200 team. That was Illinois-Chicago. East Tennessee State's top 100, Vermont's top 100. The rest are somewhere in the 140 to 160, 175 range. But again, it's home wins. It's a neutral win over Monmouth. You know, you lost your two main neutral court games to big time opponents. Do you think it's a name thing where when you look at, and I don't love bringing up, you know, brackets and polls, but the fact that they are still viewed as a top five, top 20 team, top five seed, top 20 team, or is that just more of, people think that Kentucky will just figure it out and they just don't want to look dumb putting them, you know, as a 11 seed or something like that right now?
I think it's the latter. I mean, because, you know, we all had egg on our face in 2014 when it looked like Kentucky was terrible the entire season, and then they make a run to the title game as an 8 seed. Their schedule, I think the only thing that hurts them is they haven't played a true road game.
Yeah.
All the neutral court stuff is fine. They'll get credit for playing Kansas outside of Rupp Arena. I don't know how much you read into playing Monmouth in New York, but I know Cal likes playing that, you know, one game a year up there.
That's gaming the way it's viewed, especially the way the new quadrants are.
Yeah,
that'll end up being like a tier two win, I think, the way court is. So at least it looks good to the committee.
I wonder how much Kentucky wishes it had gone ahead and played in that PK 80, because they turned that down because they only wanted to play. They knew they had the Champions Classic. They knew they had the game against UCLA in New Orleans.
Yep.
And they had their own little exempt tournament. I can't even remember what it's called, where they played all those terrible teams at Rupp.
That's the what the hell is it? That's the
it's like the Bill Keitley Invitational.
Yes. His name is slipping my mind. Yes, the Bill Keitley Classic.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they chose to do instead of going to Oregon and playing in the PK 80. Yep. I wonder how much Calipari
He just hates those back-to-back-to-back tournaments. It's like he's come out. I remember when they got done playing in Maui the Brandon Knight year. He was like, I hate playing in these things. And I understand it from both sides. Like, I understand that it doesn't really – in terms of preparing you for the NCAA tournament, yes, you're playing quality opponents, but it's not a true setup because you're not getting the day off and everything like that. But on the flip side, you're still playing – like, let's say they would have gotten to at least play, like, Ohio State or Butler there. Two teams that they – should be on a neutral court. How much does that change the way we look? Like, if they go 2-1 there and their losses to Michigan State, and the wins are, you know, Gonzaga and Butler, let's say, how much does that change the way they're viewed?
You there?
Yeah. I got you back. Right. So I was saying, yeah, like, what if they went there and played, and let's say they beat Butler, Gonzaga, and lose to Michigan State, go 2-1. How much is that perception different, right? Like, you have two neutral court wins over two tournament teams, or at least two on the fringe tournament teams, because I don't know how good Butler is.
Exactly. No, and you get a shot at, theoretically, North Carolina or Duke, or Michigan State, I guess, if you want to say that, and you're going to get at least one win that bolsters your resume. I feel like that would have been the better play. If you had to skip out in the New Orleans thing with UCLA and Ohio State, North Carolina, I feel like you do that in favor of this. But I think also people didn't really realize, and Calipari included, how successful this thing was going to be. I mean, I didn't think it would garner the type of attention that it did. But I wonder in hindsight if he could do it all over again, if Calipari would have gone ahead and book this team to play in the PK 80.
That, or how much do you think that it garnered attention just because of how good the games were? Like, you had Florida Gonzaga, that crazy, double overtime game. You had Duke Texas. You had Duke Florida. Even like Butler Ohio State was a good game. Like, it just seemed to be a lot of like kind of good, crazy games, which I think helped garner the attention. Or do you think it was just the fact that, hey, there's, 12 quality teams playing here in a 2-8-team tournament?
I think it was a lot of different facts. I mean, I think also, like, the fact that you had games going on all day when, you know, people get there wasn't great football. It's sort of a misnomer that there's all this great football happening all the time during Thanksgiving weekend and stuff.
7 games.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you get to watch the Lions get their ass beat at 12:30, and then you move on, and there's nothing to do.
You cheer against the Cowboys at 4.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same shit every single year, and it very rarely lives up to this, Thanksgiving on football hype. Yeah. And I think this year, having games throughout the day, even at odd hours, I mean, that Florida-Gonzaga game ended at like 2:15 on the East Coast AM. I think it was cool. It had a very NCAA tournament before the NCAA tournament feel to it, and I think people really bought into it. But I do think the competitive games helped. The name brands that were participating helped. And I think the environment of the games was awesome, too. I mean, like all those Gonzaga fans that were there for the Florida game, it gave it like a, you know, like a Elite Eight feel or a big time conference home game feel. It was just everything about it I thought was awesome.
Yeah, even if what I almost wish Kentucky did, because I think they're locked into that CBS Sports Classic. But talk to the SEC Big 12 Challenge, and instead of playing West Virginia, play Iowa State at home this year, or play, you know, Oklahoma State at home this year, a team that's kind of expected to be down. I know the Big 12 is kind of loaded, but, you know, take one of their two worst teams and play them in Rupp, you know, this year and go play in the PK 80.
Yeah, no, I think that would have been a better deal.
Because I understand that, you know, it'd be awesome to see, but it's at the same time just not reasonable to think a big-time program like Kentucky would play Champions Classic, CBS Sports Classic, PK 80 at West Virginia, and also playing Louisville and Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
So this game in particular, what are you watching for besides any sort of jumping off point? Like, what are you watching for in terms of individual matchup, one place where, you know, either team has a distinct advantage or anything like that?
I'm really curious to see if John Calipari swallows his pride and says, you know, to hell with the man-to-man, we're going to play a significant amount of zone because our guys can't defend.
Nope.
And I think he's going to. And, again, we're recording this Thursday night, so this could be totally null and void by the time you're listening to it. But I think Cal throws a decent amount of zone at Louisville because freshmen struggle with defense regardless of what you're playing, but they really struggle with defending, like, pick and roll and high screens and all that stuff because they've never had to do it before. You've never had to do it against quality competition. And Louisville, that's exactly what they run. I mean, they use Quentin Snyder. They trust him to make great decisions, and more times than not, he does. He's not the quickest guy in the world, but he's really good at, when he sees a little bit of daylight, effectively attacking and either getting his own shot or finding other guys. And he killed Kentucky last year when they refused to go zone. He just absolutely abused them and had the game of his life and really was the main reason why U of L won that game. So I'm curious to see if Calipari says, to hell with that, we're not going to let him beat us the same way 2 years in a row. We're going to swallow our pride and throw a zone look at Louisville for 25 or 30 minutes and see what they can do there. Because Louisville's been, not great against zone so far this year. They shoot it well enough, but they don't shoot it great. So I'm curious to see that. I'm really curious to see if Louisville is any better on the defensive glass than they've been so far. Because they have been, just god-awful against really undersized teams.
What's up with that? Because they should be a good rebounding team.
I don't get it. I mean, I get that Honest Mahmoud is lanky. I get that Ray Spalding isn't the beefiest dude in the world. But the fact that they're this bad, I mean, Albany got – they rebounded, I think, like 48% of their misses or something absurd.
And it's sometimes where the lanky dudes are sometimes the ones that you want. I know people like – you know, you look at someone like Angel Delgado who's just, you know, beef, but sometimes the lanky ones are the ones getting half the rebounds.
Well, here's the one thing, though. Here's the one reason why – I mean, Louisville's defensive rebounding is atrocious, but the one sort of justification if you're a Louisville fan is you say – they are, I think, second in the country in block shots. Mahmoud himself is fourth in block shots. And the rub is that they're blocking a lot of shots that are going right to opposing teammates, and they're getting points that way. But the thing that they've got to get better at is when Honest has a guy lined up to block his shot, Ray Spalding just comes over and sort of like flails and goes for the block too. So you've basically got two big guys going for the block, two guards trying to get out on the break and score in transition because Louisville's half-court offense hasn't been great. And then one forward just kind of standing around and being like, I hope the ball comes right to me. And that's where a lot of the second chance points from opposing teams have gone. But they're just a bad rebounding team right now. And that's got to change. They've got to develop a five guys going to the glass mentality. And I think it starts with Dangadel because he's 6'7". He's super athletic. There's no excuse for him to be rebounding and at an average of 3.4 right now.
Yeah, because he's probably going to be the one, he'll probably check Kevin Knox tomorrow?
I would guess so, yes.
And Knox is a decent offensive rebounder. I'm sure Calipari's going to say, just crash, right? Like crash the three bigs and send Diallo and either Green or Gilgeous Alexander back. Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting one because, you know, Richards has shown flashes of being a good offensive rebounder. PJ Washington, I think, can cause troubles because he's that kind of beefier type body than he is length. And, you know, can he kind of push Ray Spalding down? I think you're right there. In terms of the zone, I can't tell you how much I wish Calipari would play zone and how much I wish it's not a 2-3.
I hear it from every Kentucky fan that I talk to.
And I hate zone. I hate zone defense with all my – like, me as a player, I've never played zone defense. We played man-to-man my entire life. I am not – like, when I coached, I rarely ever put in a zone defense. When I did, it was never a 2-3, and I hate that they're going to run a 2-3 zone when they do.
Oh, you know, that's exactly what's going to happen. Yep. But the thing is, at some point, you've got to say – this is just it's the college game. It's the way it is. I mean, Krzyzewski's done it. You
right,
know?
But go like 1-2-2.
Yeah, well,
and
you
know, extend the pressure. Like, you know, the college game. How many times do we see college kids just literally just lose their mind when they see some sort of press? Right. It happens. Oh. Happens in the NCAA tournament every year.
Oh, I mean, West Virginia has formed a new identity on just being like, you know what? We need a gimmick. We don't have the best scores. So what are we going to do? We're going to play a funky half court defense, and we're just going to foul the shit out of you on our full court press and dare anybody to call all these fouls. And, you know, when it works, we're going to win games. When it doesn't work, we may lose to decent teams by 50, but to hell with it. People are going to be talking about us.
Well, that's like what I think Kentucky can do, because just with their length, just trap everywhere, right? Like run a 1-2-2-3 quarters and just trap wherever you can.
It'd be a really smart philosophy, too, against Louisville, because they've got, I mean, in their starting lineup, Snyder's the only quality ball handler.
Yeah, and he's, what, 6'2"?
Yeah, if that. He's solid, but he can't do it all by himself. Dengadel, that's the one area where I think fans were really hoping he would improve over the summer, going to Adidas Nations and some of these other camps, and it really hasn't happened. He's still very shaky with the ball. VJ King is honestly even shakier with the ball, and then you've got two bigs there. The backcourt depth is fine. Ryan McMahon is solid enough. Darius Perry can handle it a little bit. Jordan Warwick can do his thing. But there's, I mean, if you're Kentucky, by just causing havoc on the defensive end, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, especially with guys like Gilgeous Alexander, who, again, his size, his length, and he's, you know, he's just better just kind of running amok, right? Like, he just kind of gets lost, and he's better just running better. Like, he'd be perfect on West Virginia, as crazy as that sounds. Like, he'd be perfect out there.
I feel like that's kind of Kentucky's sort of MO with a lot of guys this year, is like, just let them be floaters. Like, they just let them kind of like go around and be athletic. Like, they don't do anything great, but they all kind of do the same things pretty well.
Right. Like, let Nick Richards just, you know, protect the rim. Especially, like, a guy like Wenyen Gabriel. When he's in, let him just run around and trap. He's a ball, like, he's a puppy. He's a ball of energy. And he's just going to – he's going to barrel into people and pick up a couple fouls, but he'll also probably draw a couple steals.
That's sort of like if you're not Kevin Knox or Hami Diallo, that's sort of like your role on this year's Kentucky team, right. I feel like. Yeah, like, and that's why I think this could definitely be one of those UK U of L years where, like, a random Kentucky guy just goes off. Like, I think that could absolutely happen.
Yeah, this feels like a Wenyen Gabriel type game, or a – I'm trying to think, like, who would be a good random selection. Like, you know, Washington has gone off enough where I don't think he's random, but, you know, like, maybe this is the Gilgeous Alexander game.
I feel like he's the first name that came to my mind. Yeah. I feel like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander could be this year's Josh Harrelson.
Right, right. Where it's just all of a sudden you look up and he has, you know, 19, 5 assists and 4 steals or something like that. And
you're like, Knox only has 8, but hey, we're down by 20 because this random dude has dropped 25 on us.
So for Kentucky, I've been saying this, and I want your opinion from a non-Kentucky standpoint is – to me, the two most important people to them offensively, it's not Kevin Knox. It's Kwadi Green and Hamidou Diallo, and they're shooting. They were going into the UCLA game Green was at 44%, and Diallo was at 39%. I don't think that's who they really are. I think they're more 40-36-ish. If they are shooting the ball at that level where it at least keeps defenses honest and opens up the lane for Knox, Washington, and Richards and, you know, whatever bigs he's throwing out there, do you think that's a fair take, or do you think it's something more intrusive than that?
I think you're absolutely right. And I said the same thing earlier today on our radio show here. I think if Louisville doesn't beat Kentucky beyond the arc, then it's really going to have a hard time winning the game. I think that's the one area where they have to get the best of UK. And they won't do it if Quade Green is having one of his games where he's knocking it down from the outside at a higher clip than he's typically used to. If Hami Diallo, which I've been stunned by his outside shooting when I've seen Kentucky this year, at how good he is and how good the shot looks.
Like, yeah, it's not a broken shot.
It's not. And that was what you heard all summer when he was mulling the decision about whether or not to go pro, was that, you know, this kid's athleticism is off the charts. He's going to dunk, but he can't really dribble or score. He's not a polished player. He hasn't looked that way to me so far this year, and that's been shocking. But I think you're totally spot on about both those guys. If they shoot at an abnormally high rate from the outside, that could be enough to really be the total determining factor in this game. Because Quade's got to make up for the fact that he's not a traditional Calipari point guard in some way. He's got to make up for the fact that he's not De'Aaron Fox or John Wall or Brandon Knight or even Marcus Teague. And by shooting at a high rate outside, that's one way to make that happen.
Yeah, I think he's somewhere, you know, freshman year Tyler Ulis-like, which is kind of what he should be looking at.
You think he's that good?
I think that's what he could be.
Okay.
Like, I really like his game, and I liked his game coming into the year. And it's just when he gets going, he's like that. Like, when he's in a rhythm, when he is playing with confidence, he reminds me of that. Because they kind of have similar games in the – even the way like he shoots the ball reminds me of Ulis shooting the ball, especially his freshman year. I don't think he'll ever turn into sophomore year Tyler Ulis, but I think freshman year Tyler Ulis is kind of what he should strive to be like. So what's your prediction of the game? Obviously,
I'm wrong about this game more times than not, especially recently. The Courier Journal here in Louisville asked me for my prediction yesterday, and I gave it to him, and I said, Kentucky 72, Louisville 68. I feel like, I mean, the team's problems are different, but the total makeup of the teams are sort of the same. Like, I feel like they're basically they basically have the same resume at this point. The fan bases feel the same way about the teams. And so when things are that similar, I got to give sort of deference to the fact that the game's at Rupp Arena. The fact that John Calipari is a Hall of Fame coach and he's going up against a guy who's coaching his 13th game.
Yeah.
To me, like, I wouldn't be shocked if Louisville won. I'm not obviously not going to be shocked if Kentucky wins, but I'd be shocked if either side just dominated.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the general consensus, right? Like, it doesn't feel like it's going to be – it might get to 10 points because of free throws at the end of the game or something like that.
Yeah, I thought – I don't know if you saw the line, but the first line that came out today
– 6.5.
I thought that was big. That to me was surprising.
I thought it was going to be about 5.
That's exactly what I said. I thought it would be right at 5, and I thought that would be right. I wonder how much of it is just Rupp Arena and the fact right. That Vegas doesn't trust Louisville playing in that scenario with everything else that it's had to deal with already.
That, and I wonder if it's also Vegas thinking, okay, Kentucky's not going to put up back-to-back duds.
Yeah, because what I've seen Calipari after losses is like 39-8 at Kentucky or something like
it's
that.
Something like that. Like, it's rare that there's back-to-back losses.
It's just surprising to me because we've seen, you know, in this game that they, you know, everybody's familiar with the fact that Calipari went 8-2 against Patino, but Louisville's rarely been this big of a dog. And maybe that's because the computer rankings like them more, but this is the biggest underdog they've been against Kentucky since that 2012 Final Four game, which was like the biggest Final Four point spread and I think like 15 years or something along those lines.
Because even KenPom has it as a 5-point game.
Right.
And that's usually, if it's more than a point, I mean, I'm talking even a half a point, it's a little bit of a surprise to see.
Right. I mean, I think last year people were surprised when Louisville opened up as a 2-point favorite, but that's exactly what KenPom had it as. And then I think Kentucky actually tipped off as like a point and a half favorite when all was said and done. But
yeah,
favorites haven't done all that well in this series, at least when it comes to covering. I think they failed to cover in 8 of the last 9 games, which is wild.
And I do wonder if this line will jump up just because of how many people. Kentucky is just a team that gets inflated. And then, same thing with Duke, same thing with Carolina and Kansas, just because people that know that watch, that are casual fans of college basketball, just bet on Kentucky, bet on teams like that.
So it could be.
I almost wonder if this will jump up to 7, which would be way too high, I feel like. Yeah, I agree. I think I'm somewhere along the same lines of you, where I think Kentucky wins like 75-69 type feel. But it's close the entire time, and then, you know, free throws, miss 3 at the end, something like that, and it gets to 6. I agree it's going to be a random, and it feels this way. Like, even last year, like, Quentin Snyder was kind of the random hero. I know Snyder has been been around for a while, but if you would have bet, you know, if I would have bet who was the one to lead Louisville last year in points and win the game, I would not have bet on Quentin Snyder.
Yeah, it's wild to look back at last year's game and see, because, I mean, everybody, like, every Louisville fan in the world is saying, you know, look at Donovan Mitchell. Like, imagine this team with Donovan Mitchell. Donovan Mitchell wasn't great in last year's Kentucky game.
No,
I think he hit 2 late free throws, but I think he was like 3 of 12 from the field. The 2 best players for Louisville in last year's game were Quentin Snyder and Deng Adel. So if you're a Louisville fan looking for some sort of confidence right now, you got to feel pretty good about that. Although Quentin was terrible in Rupp Arena 2 years ago, no points. That he was sort of the reason why they lost that 2-point game. Damian Lee was terrific.
That's right. I remember watching the game. Lee's gonna be one of those forgotten great 1-year players, obviously for different reasons, but he was so good.
Shout out to Damian too. He's marrying Steph Curry.
Yeah,
sister.
I saw that.
Yeah.
She looks a lot like Steph Curry.
She does. I hope they send their spawn to Louisville. I would appreciate it.
I mean, that would be a good step. So let's end into just some quick general college basketball thoughts, because obviously you write quite a bit about everything in the college basketball world. So I think we have to start with Trae Young. And I tweeted this out yesterday. I got one complaint with Trae Young, and it's the fact that everybody that's a talking head just goes, well, he's the best guard since Steph Curry at the college level. And that's the most annoying thing in the world to me, because there have been so many other good guards in that time frame.
Yeah.
I know he's putting up historic numbers and he's shooting lights out, but to me, he's a lot more D'Angelo Russell than he is Steph Curry. And I don't know if I'm crazy for that or not.
I get why. Okay, so, like, I'm not a guy that follows recruiting all that much. I tend to sort of like Ricky O'Donnell does that for us at SB Nation. Does a great job. He goes and sees all those kids, and then he tells me something, and I'm like, all right, I'll take your word for it. I'm gonna watch the YouTube video. But I heard the one thing that you heard about Trae Young for, I guess, the past calendar year was that Steph Curry comparison.
Yeah.
And when I watch him play, I'm like, yeah, I don't think it's fair. But I get why people say it, because he's got that smoothness to his game. He's got that if you give him a foot or two, he's going to pull from anywhere. He's got that just innate feel for where his teammates are. And so I get why that comparison is being made. But as far as him being the best guard in college basketball since Steph Curry, oh, there have been plenty of great guards.
Right.
I think he's the most exciting player that college basketball has had since Jimmer Fredette. Is that fair?
No, I completely agree with that. Just because there's been a lot of different players since that time frame. Because what year was he? He was 2011?
Yeah, he and Kemba were the year Kemba Walker and him were kind of dueling for player of the year. Even though Kemba didn't win Big East player of the year, went to my man Ben Hansbrough.
That's right.
But I think like he's the one guy that, you know, not only does he take crazy shots and make crazy shots, he's the one dude who in college basketball can put up numbers that like make the entire sports world take notice, right?
Like when he
broke tied the assist record the other night, it was the top trending topic on Twitter. It didn't matter that it was Oklahoma versus Northwestern State. People are now just generally curious to see what ridiculous thing this kid's going to do next, which is why Jimmer was so attractive back in the day.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement, because, you know, even when you look at some of the big names that have come through college basketball in that that time frame. Like, you know, they're, like, Anthony Davis was just a different player than, obviously, than the guards, where it's just not as electric to watch a big guy dominate, I'd say. Then, you know, you have someone like Frank Mason, who, you know, I'm just thinking a different player of the years, where, yeah, you know, he was good, he was fun in his own right, but he wasn't this. Like, he wasn't exciting. He was just a tough nose. I'm going to go drop 25 on you and motherfuck you up and down the court. Like, and that's fun, and that's fun for, like, hoop heads, but in terms of, like, and the ultimate goal is getting the casual fan involved as early as possible. I agree. I don't think there's anyone close to the excitement level since Jimmer.
How much do you think that, like, what Trae Young's doing right now is taking away from, like, the focus and the hype that Marvin Bagley would be getting otherwise?
Oh, what about DeAndre Ayton?
Yeah, I mean, right. Both those guys do stuff that you don't typically see freshman big men right. do, and they're kind of afterthoughts right now.
And think even to go even further than that, just because with how good the bigs in the freshman class are, Brandon McCoy is averaging a double-double at UNLV.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, yeah, he's also a freshman. And I know it's like people sit there and say UNLV, he was a big-time recruit. He's going to be a first-round pick. Like, it's not, you know, some guy just coming out of nowhere here. I agree. I think Young is kind of taken away from not only the freshman class, but what about someone like Jalen Brunson, who's putting up just ridiculous shooting splits and numbers for the best team in the country?
It's just further evidence that you can never force the major storyline in college basketball. Like when ESPN tried to do the Ben Simmons thing a couple years ago and refused to back down, even though they were, you know, like had a losing record in the SEC. They were hyping up an LSU-Alabama game like it was an LSU-Alabama football game, which was ridiculous. And then this year, you know, Grayson Allen is supposed to be the most recognizable face that college basketball has had since Tyler Hansbrough. And, I mean, he's not being talked about all that much, despite having a ridiculous performance in the biggest, you know, night of the early part of the season. It's all been about this kid from Oklahoma that really nobody besides diehard college basketball fans was even aware of a month ago. It's just, you can never force the narrative in college basketball. It's going to appear on its own.
Not speaking of that, how about someone like Miles Bridges, who was everyone's like, not, I'm not going to say consensus because I was a contrarian and didn't pick him, but preseason National Player of the Year, consensus first team All-American. If the season ends now, is he maybe a third team All-American?
Yeah, if that, and he's been good. Like that,
right. he's been really good. It's just it's been a lot of this, you know, just dominant performance from guys that have come out of nowhere. It seems like, or not come out of nowhere, but have made the jump that a lot of people didn't expect.
Yeah, I mean, Bridges has been really good for a team that I think most people would still agree is probably one of the top like
two best teams in
top,
the country,
yeah, I'd say, but like. Yeah. I'd say top three most likely to win the national championship at the end of the year. I think that's fair.
I would agree with that.
I feel like Nova, Duke, and Michigan State right now are all the safe bets, and everybody else is kind of it's sort of a free for all after that. But he's been their best player, and he's had highlight reel moments, and he's done great stuff. But maybe Michigan State just hasn't had enough of a spotlight thing, or maybe Trae Young is taking away. But it's crazy. We were supposed to have all these self hand picked superstars that were going to dominate the sport, especially at the beginning of the season when, you know, the rest of the country, the casual fans, aren't paying all that much attention. And that hasn't been the case at all. It's been a 6'1" kid from Oklahoma who's putting up outrageous numbers.
What outside of Trae Young, because I think he would be an answer that most people would say here, who has a realistic chance to be this year's Kemba and Shabazz, where they can take a decent team, an okay team, and win a title just with them putting it on their back?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Reason I asked is because I wrote a blog about it today, and it was on my mind all day.
I was going to say, I feel like you've probably got somebody picked out.
I do.
I mean, like the early answer, and he's kind of fallen off a little bit too. Well, as his team has too. Jordan Murphy got a lot of love at Minnesota right off the bat.
That's a good one.
I mean, Bonzi at Notre Dame, say things. Trey Holder, maybe at Arizona State, would be the guy who kind of becomes a household name. If they can somehow keep this up, I would love to see. I think it'd be good for the sport for a power conference team that isn't really synonymous with the sport to become a top five team that's competing for a national title and has kind of a breakout star that wasn't getting a lot of attention before the year. So that'll be my answer. I'll say Trey Holder.
I gave him as kind of a runner-up. I went with Trayvon Blewett.
Yeah, that's the better answer.
The reason I went with him instead of Holder, because I listed like Holder and Javon Carter as two guys that kind of came to mind, but I went with Blewett because Arizona State can beat you in other ways. Like Shannon Evans can go score 30, and West Virginia will just beat you. Like you said, they'll just trap the hell out of you and foul the hell out of you. Xavier, everyone kind of agrees that Makura is like their second go-to guy, but he's so streaky.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, well then what's after Blewett? And I feel like Blewett, and I think Xavier's a top five team in the country. I have him five right now, but I feel like they can only win with Blewett doing what he's doing, which is the 20 a game. And, you know, against Marquette, he leads them in points, assists and rebounds. I think he's one of those guys that's still floating a little bit under the radar because of the Trae Youngs and the Jalen Brunsons and the Mikal Bridges of the world.
No, like that's the better answer. I totally agree with you. I think he is and he's also, I mean, he's got that type of just full takeover mode about him. I mean, he did it in the NCAA tournament last year.
Yeah, so we watched a lot of it last year in March.
Yeah, I mean, he's got that, like, you know, holy shit, this guy's trending on Twitter. You've got to see what he's doing.
Right.
Find wherever the hell FS1 is on your TV and watch Xavier play some basketball. He's got that quality about him. And you're right. If he has a bad game, I wonder how many people listening to this off the top of their heads can name a Xavier player besides Trayvon Blewett or JP Makura. Because right. I mean, there's not a whole lot. I mean, I know. I mean, I think Louisville fans
I'll give a hint. Matt Stainbrook isn't there.
Yeah. Unfortunately for all of us, he's driving Uber somewhere. If you hadn't heard that story, by the way, Matt Stainbrook, Uber, that was the greatest beat to death story of all time. Louisville fans here maybe can name Quentin Gooden because he's from this area and filled in last year. But there's just not a lot of, I mean, if Blewett doesn't do crazy stuff, it feels like Xavier's going to be hard pressed to beat anybody good.
Yeah.
So that's the better answer. And he's just fantastic overall.
He is, man. He's a lot of fun to watch. And It's crazy, though, because looking around, this was supposed to be the year that upperclassmen kind of dominated the sport, right? And it's like looking around, it's how many seniors have truly had these great years? Like, if you had to list the 15 All-Americans right now, how many truly like seniors would honestly be considered? You had Holder, you have Blewett, and then who?
Yeah, I mean, you've got, well, Brunson's a junior.
Bridges is a junior. Murphy's a junior. Like, Jock Landale hasn't lived up to the hype. Angel Delgado has been fine, but he's getting double and triple teamed every time
they play. Like, I guess Desi Rodriguez has been really good.
Purdue sort of led by veteran guys. But besides that, no, you're right. This is supposed to be, you know, the year of the returnees and Grayson Allen being great and guys we're familiar with. And you know, North Carolina is going to be led by its returnees from the national championship team. And it really hasn't been the case. It's been dominated more by the young guys than even some past years that we thought were going to be dominated by the young guys.
What's your take on UNC? Because I think they're a weird team this year.
Their
resume kind of shows it.
I know you and I, we sort of had a back and forth the last time I did this. And you are totally thumping your chest over what UNC has done in the past couple of weeks, and deservedly so. I mean, they pumped the brakes on everybody who was like, "Well, we wrote off UNC too fast."
Right, but they do have wins against Northern Iowa, Bucknell, Arkansas, you know, Michigan, and Tennessee, and Ohio State, and some of them were ass kickings, and you know, some were at home, some on the road. Their resume is just weird because then they got their ass kicked by Michigan State, and then obviously the Wofford game. So I'm just curious because I feel like neutral on them from where I started the season.
I think the big question now is how much does if he ever can play, you know, how much does a new guy like Cam Johnson help this team? Because there are so many. Like you said a couple months ago, this team's going to have to find a way to win in a way that's foreign to what they're used to. Because you can't do the, we're just bigger than everybody, we're just going to dominate with second chance points anymore. And so far, the way that they've found a way to be good again is by having Luke May be better than anybody thought he could ever be.
Yeah, that's
That's insane. Like, that's almost as big of a story as Trae Young.
No, it is. And he's been, I mean, what, he's averaging 19 and 11 or something absurd, like, along those lines.
Yeah.
I mean, we all kind of thought he was going to be a nice player who was always best known for hitting one shot against Kentucky. And instead, he's looked like, you know, maybe the ACC player of the year so far. I don't know if that's is that sustainable? I mean, is that going to continue? I agree. There's no way.
I think we saw what happens when he plays. And I know it's a rare, it's not extremely fair to say this because there's not a lot of Michigan States of the world, but when he plays teams that have athletic and talented bigs, we see him kind of get eaten up, right? Like, yeah, that's what happened in Michigan State. Even the Wofford game, like, he was terrible until the last 10, 12 minutes when he kind of, I mean, he finished a double-double, but if you look at his box score, like, he took a lot of shots to get there. He got outplayed by Cam Jackson of Wofford. And I just don't think it's sustainable in the ACC. Like, I think teams have just been so dead set on, all right, well, we're going to take away Joel Berry, that he's found open shots. And credit to Roy, like, he's gotten him some good looks on some nice set plays. But, like you mentioned, Cam Johnson coming into the fold now, that's just, by force of nature, going to take away some shots and going to take away some stats. And I think, you know, guys like Manley and Brooks will just start developing a little bit more. And again, now you maybe lose two more buckets there, and he's down to, I still think he's going to finish with like an average of like 15 and 8, which is insane.
That's, yeah, I think that's exactly where I would peg him to. The one thing that Carolina, I think, is concerning and maybe you hope would improve is I thought Theo Pinson would be more of an offensive player this year. And he hasn't done much besides be the same Theo Pinson that we've seen for the past 3 years. He scored well against Ohio State. I think he scored like 18 or 19, which is promising, but most of that came from the free throw line. I don't know. Like, Carolina just doesn't have that dude besides Berry or May at this point who, you know, you feel like you can trust to have a good, maybe great game against a quality opponent. And I feel like that's why they're still sort of, you know, top four, top five in the ACC, but maybe ceiling as a regional final if they get the right draw in a couple breaks. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like that's right. Speaking of right draw and breaks, what streak ends first? The West Coast or the Big Ten winning a national title?
Good question. I'm going to say the West Coast one because West Coast basketball has been better recently, and I feel like the talent's going to keep going out there. They're going to be able to keep some of that homegrown talent more out there. And the Big Ten, I mean, hell, if Michigan State doesn't do it this year,
when?
I don't know. I feel like they're not going to do it, though. I think they'll be right there in the end. But I don't think that Michigan State's going to win a national title this year. And obviously nobody else from the Big Ten is going to win a national title this year. I don't know. I mean, a lot of it probably hinges on what happens with Arizona. I mean, if they can deal with this stuff the right way, if they can, you know, get out from underneath this black cloud that's kind of halfway hovering over them right now, that's probably the most likely pick. I don't know if Gonzaga is going to have a better chance than they did a year ago, but I'll stick with one team from the West Coast in the next 3 or 4 years getting hot, winning a national title before one team from the Big Ten does.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. I'll let you get out of there with that. Where can everyone find your stuff?
You can go to cardchronicle.com. That's for Louisville stuff. SBNation.com's got all my general college basketball stuff. And you can follow me on Twitter at cardchronicle, all one word.
All right, man. Thanks again for coming on.
Thanks, Riggs. I appreciate it.
All right, everyone else, follow the show, Fundamental ESD. Follow me on Twitter, on Barstool Riggs. All my stuff on Barstool Sports. And I will be back sometime after the holiday. Going to try to figure out the schedule with Ben and everything like that going forward. So we'll figure it out, and we'll talk to everybody then.